Good afternoon. It's time for Animal Voices. My name is Allart, and with me co-hosting is Carl Loskin. Marge is in the studio as well, Marge Adams. And on sound, we have Alan Jensen. You're listening to CFRO 102.7 FM. Today, we have some great interviews going on. One is with Michael Parfit, who has got an award-winning film out right now. It's called Saving Luna. As some of you may remember that there was an orca whale at Nootka Sound that was extremely friendly. Well, Michael Parfit and his wife, Suzanne Chisholm, made a documentary film about it. And I saw it at the Vancouver International Film Festival. It was a beautiful film. There will be one more showing of the film, and that will be on Sunday. Now, if you haven't gone out to the Vancouver Film Festival, today is the last day of the film festival. However, they are bringing back some of the raving films. I shouldn't say raving. The films that were raved about at the film festival, they're bringing back over the weekend. So if you go to the Vancouver International Film Festival website, you can Google it, I'm sure you'll find it, and look that up. You can check out some of these films. They have had some amazing, there's a Kyoto Planet effort going on to educate people about what's going on the planet, and there have been some amazing films. There's one called The Planet, and it really showed a lot about how we are just consuming way too much, and we are consuming more than the planet can regenerate. So and the species are dying, the animals are dying, the plants are dying, going extinct. And it's something that we really need to become more aware of. We can't afford to stick our head in the sand any longer and say, let somebody else take care of it. We all have to play a part in turning this around. Otherwise, we are contributing to the problem. So there's a number of films out there like that that is well worth your time to go and see. Carl, what are you going to be doing today?
At the half-hour mark, we'll be interviewing Gary Charbonneau, and he's a vegan and a member of EarthSave, and he's interested in environmental affairs. He and his girlfriend went to the $500 at $250 entrance fee Al Gore Inconvenient Truth presentation at the Bayshore Inn. Went with his bicycle, and he's going to tell us his impressions. So that at the half-hour mark today.
Of Nobel Prize winning Al Gore.
Yes.
Amazing.
And Marge, are you doing anything today or you're just sitting in?
I have a couple of announcements about local events coming up.
Okay. Well, we'll get some of those later. My next guest, Michael Parfit, is the producer-director of the film, as I mentioned, Saving Luna, that is playing at the Vancouver International Film Festival. Michael has a degree in journalism. He's written 4 books and numerous articles for National Geographic and Smithsonian and other magazines. He co-wrote the script for the IMAX film Antarctica and wrote the script for the award-winning IMAX film Ocean Oasis. He also co-wrote Under Antarctic Ice. He and his wife, Suzanne Chisholm, they have written a number of documentary films. They specialize in stories about the relationships between people and the natural world, and they're married and they live on a small island in B.C. So they've done a number of films. It says here that they've produced and filmed over 20 stories for the National Geographic Channel. And their subjects are diverse, from puffins to the Inuit of Nunavut, Newfoundland fisheries, rising sea levels in the Netherlands. There's all kinds of things that they're doing. So Saving Luna is a feature-length documentary for CBC News World, The Knowledge Network, and APTN. So thank you for joining us on the program today, Michael.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Michael, it was such a beautiful movie. It was such a feel-good movie to watch this movie. There's a tragic ending. But what compelled you to do this movie?
We were compelled by it. I think it wasn't our motivation. It was the animal that we met, Luna, kind of grabbed hold of us and wouldn't let go. We went to Nootka Sound to do what we thought was going to be a small story about a whale there. This was back in 2004. And we met Luna, and things developed, and of course they changed quite dramatically over the course of the next weeks. And we wound up essentially staying there for about 3 years to work on the story, and eventually we got involved in trying to, you know, as the title says, save Luna. So it really grabbed us as opposed to us going out and getting it. It just, we couldn't escape it.
Yeah, and so did you do all of the footage that we saw, or was that collected from other sources as well?
No, some of that is collected from other sources. The very early footage of the first period of time that he was in Nootka Sound was before we got there. So there's some of that early footage. Some of it was shot by individuals who are out on the water themselves. Some of it was from the Department of Fisheries and Oceans.
Could you tell our listeners the story about Luna, how Luna got there?
Well, the how he got there is kind of a mystery. He was born quite near San Juan Island on the U.S. side of the border to the southern residents, who are the group of whales that come back to this area between Victoria and Vancouver during the course of the summer and then disappear in the wintertime. He was born there. They travel in the winter, and the next winter after he was born, they came back, and he didn't. He disappeared. Everyone assumed that he was dead. And then all of a sudden, this little whale showed up in Nootka Sound, halfway up Vancouver Island, and it turned out to be Luna, which was astonishing right from the beginning. Then he started, they're extremely social animals. If anything, they need contact with other beings more than even humans do, and you know how much we do. We can't stand to be alone, and he couldn't stand to be alone. The only thing there that he found of interest to him was human beings, so he tried to make contact with us. And to me, that was like fables. We were always thinking about how cool it would be if we managed to break through the wall that exists between us and other species and make friends. And it always seemed so simple, but of course it wasn't simple. And so there was a lot of controversy over whether people should actually play with him when he came to play with them. And eventually, it got quite complicated. and the Department of Fisheries and Oceans decided to move Luna back to the Victoria area to try to re-engage him with his pod. But the First Nation up there, the Moichat Muchlet people, believed that he was carried the spirit of their late chief. And they opposed his being captured. And in a kind of a dramatic showdown, a sort of classic civil disobedience, they went out and just sang songs to Luna and prevented him from being captured and moved.
That was a very powerful aspect of the film, too, seeing the First Nations people out in the canoes singing these songs and trying to get between the fisheries department's boats and Luna, and trying to entice Luna to come and see them instead of the fisheries boats, because Luna was, she just loved everybody, didn't he?
Yes, he did. It's always hard to remember. I find even after all these years, Luna just feels like a feminine name, so we always tend to call him she, but he was definitely a boy. He sort of went to work in the timber industry there, playing with the boom boats and all these things. But it was a very, very dramatic period while the First Nations were out there defending him. They were very afraid that the Department of Fisheries and Oceans was going to send him to an aquarium as opposed to really helping him get back together with his pod. So that was a huge part of their motivation.
But that was an option that the Department of Fisheries did discuss, didn't they? They said
they did more than discuss it. They really had logistics in place to send him to an aquarium. And once they released him in the Victoria area, there were actually memos saying, we're not going to wait very long before we decide that he has to go to a tank instead. So it was not very well publicized, so it was quite likely actually that he would have wound up going to an aquarium.
Oh, that's sad. And they, was this their second choice? They're saying, well, if he won't be reunited with the pod, then we'll send him to an aquarium? Or were they saying, nah, let's not bother with that, let's just go straight to the aquarium?
No, absolutely, to be fair to the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, they were definitely going to release him. And give him the opportunity to reunite. And a lot of people believed that he would successfully reunite. The thing that made it a little bit weird was that the scientists at the Department of Fisheries and Oceans did not really believe he would successfully reunite with his pod, and that's why they were so vigorous in pursuing the option of sending him to an aquarium.
And why is it that they didn't think he would reunite? Was that because he was split off in the first place?
Because he'd been apart from pod for several years, they thought that perhaps that he had been rejected by them to begin with. So it was all quite speculative, you know. There's very, very little actual science here for people to go on because this is such a special event. I mean, it was not unique here because there had been another whale that had gone through something similar. But it's highly unusual. There's nothing, mostly guesswork on everyone's part.
Yeah. I want to hear more about all this controversy, but one of the things I would really like our listeners to know is how friendly Luna was. What were the kinds of antics that she was doing with people?
Oh, he was just, he practically would get in the boat, you know. At first, at the very beginning, he was probably the most intensely friendly as he was sort of trying to establish relationships. He would come up and open his mouth to get his tongue scratched. We've got some footage of that, and it's quite extraordinary. The audience is always, we don't sort of predict it in the narration, so the audience is always sort of half gasp a little bit when they start to see people putting their hands down Luna's throat. So, it's really quite striking.
Yeah, yes, it is. And of course, he was constantly seeking out the boats and swimming right next to the boats and sticking his head up and playing with the people.
Yes, it was quite amazing. He loved to play with boat fenders, you know, the rubber things beside the boat. People would throw them to him, and he'd toss them around and then bring them back like a retriever. He would also bring over pieces of cedar bark, which he loved to hang out. He'd carry bits of cedar bark around with him while he was doing all kinds of things, and then he'd bring them to people and play sort of tug of war. What was amazing was to watch how he could tease you with a piece of cedar bark and then just keep it like 2 inches away from your hand as you reached for it. That sort of precision working in water like that, I mean, his control over himself in the water was just amazing.
Yeah, and then he'd let you get close and he'd yank it away from you.
He would just keep it just out of reach.
Yeah.
And we've got footage of that. It's really quite amazing.
It is. It's very amusing, too, because, what was your impressions of the intelligence of Luna?
Well, I think that's one of the sort of major subtexts of our film is that when I met him and when other people met him, the sense of being in the presence of a very complex and extremely aware being was striking. And I felt conclusively by the end of the whole thing that here was an animal who was as aware of living and of the world as I was. And that was sort of, in a way, it was sort of shocking because we think of ourselves as having this kind of dominant awareness and appreciation of the world. And I just couldn't hang on to that sort of self-aggrandizement when I was with Luna, because the sense that he really knew the world just as well as I did, and in his really different way, was compelling. And I think that's one of the things that we try to tell through this film, you know, in a light way. We just want to show people that, because, you know, the story itself is dramatic and all of that, but beneath it there was this sense that, oof, you know, this really makes you rethink your entire relationship to the world and to the other beings that live in it.
Yeah, especially we can call those other beings animals. I mean, this is a show about animal voices, so we're constantly talking about people's attitudes towards animals all the time. So I'm glad that you did this. And I was aware, I did pick up on what the message you were trying to give as far as the intelligence of Luna, because certainly there was a lot of people in your film that said that when Luna's eye looked at you, that they just got this sense that Luna was looking right into them.
Yeah, real connection. And if, you remember one line in there, the guy is a person who runs a resort, and he says, well, when you look in his eyes, said, there's a lot more there than most of my guests.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about this film. It's a very moving film, but, man, people really laugh. There's a lot of funny stuff in there.
Yeah.
Some of it I didn't even know when I edited it was going to be funny, but it is.
Yes, that's true. And I think he made a key point there, too, is because what I was seeing in Luna was a lot of complex emotions. And I thought, you know, we often attribute those emotions to only to human beings, that other animals couldn't possibly feel the same way. But Luna was exhibiting these emotions that we don't give them credit for. And that was so in my face to see that.
Yes, it was striking. And there's the complexity and the sort of subtlety of it was the thing that it's hard to get across in film. I think we do to some degree. It was something to really dramatically to experience. It really is the sort of thing that there's a lot of Luna on film that we took. And I think it's a cumulative thing. As you watch the film, you gradually get to know him and you get a sense of his subtleties and of his awareness. I mean, you know, we don't even conceive of the way that he sees underwater because he does it with sound.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he may have visualizations in his head that are far more acute than, let's say, our ultrasound devices that we use, you know, to look at babies and pregnant mothers. He may have an actual sort of what we would think of as a visual conception through his sound. I mean, he may. Who knows? We don't know. But it's just stunning to think about.
Well, that's true. And the fact that he does have to see underwater, when those eyes that can see underwater are looking at the people and they're so struck by those eyes, who knows what that animal is seeing?
Yes, exactly. And the sense that we could connect, I mean, is, you know, it's just stunning. You sort of think about it as sort of automatic. Well, yeah, we sort of connect with our dogs and so on. A wild animal comes to us and asks for something, which in the film we call friendship. But, you know, it was something that doesn't quite fit that word. We don't really know what it was. It was companionship. It was social life. It was all those things that we wrap up in that simple term, friendship.
I would use the word love, too. I just saw so much love coming from this animal.
You know, I think that's a word we can use, but all of these human words, it's like us going to, you know, to Nunavut and using the word snow. They're approximations. They don't sum it up. There's something more that is sort of almost beyond our language to express.
That's true, and much of it is that connection, and the trust. I think trust was a thing. The fact that this animal would trust people so readily. I mean, to me, I just thought, that's got to warm the hardest heart. You know, I mean, my heart was, I don't have a hard heart, but my heart was opening. As the more I saw of this, I thought, surely even the most coldest, meanest human being could not be that way in the face of this kind of contact. Is that a fair statement?
You know, it is to a large degree. I mean, the people who loved Luna were of all walks of life, of all cultures, of all persuasions. There were, however, some people for whom Luna did not tug at the heart and who became both afraid and angry at him. And that's the big reason that we felt that we needed to try to step in to help save him, because as time went on, the government kind of washed their hands of him and said, you know, he's just going to get killed and there's nothing much we can do about it, so let's just sort of lament him to begin, you know, before it even happened. And so we tried to stop that, and we were not successful, to our, you know, everlasting grief. But there were people who were scared of him and saw him as just this sort of...
Were they out to do him in?
There were people who were out to do him in, yeah. There were people who said they were going to shoot him if the government didn't take him away or shoot him themselves. There were people who thought of him as dangerous as a garbage bear. People who really knew him, or even knew him slightly, knew that wasn't the case. But, well, I could understand how someone in a small boat who had just caught, let's say, a 5-pound salmon and thought that was the biggest thing in the world, all of a sudden, a huge whale comes up beside their bike. I see people being afraid, But all we needed to do in that case was give him what he was asking for in a more sort of straightforward, honest, consistent way, and I think we could have saved his life and made him a real link between us and the world.
Right. And now one of the things I appreciated that the First Nations people were doing, and we only have a few minutes left, but I like that they said that, if this is what nature, let nature take its course, and the fact that this has come into being, that we should show respect for allowing it to and allow it to happen out of respect. It was a statement I thought was very strong.
It was. And the character, the person who makes that statement, is very philosophical, thoughtful elder of the Mochut Muchlut people. We learned a lot from him and from others there about those approaches to the natural world.
And now, would you just tell us finally what ended up happening to Luna, the tragedy?
Yeah, for people here, it's not something most of us remember. In March of 06, a large tug came into Nootka Sound, and he was hit by the propeller and was killed instantly. I happened to be away, I had been kind of keeping a lookout on him and that sort of thing, and I can't help but wish that I had been there, or maybe could have prevented it, but it did happen, as sort of was predicted. What was tragic is that no one had the opportunity to try some of the ideas of learning how to protect him that we might have been able to do.
Yeah, and I mentioned in the Q&A afterwards, you mentioned that there was no investigation that was done into that, so that the idea that this actually happened, I mean, as far as any maliciousness or anything, was that a question in people's minds?
Well, not really. It's just impossible to know what people did out there. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans called it an accident. The problem really is that there are people who say, well, oh yeah, maybe he did it intentionally. It's totally unfair to the skipper of the boat for there not to have been an investigation that would clear him.
Yeah.
It's unfair to the people who loved Luna for there not to be an investigation of any significance. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans dropped the ball there, and so the guy whose boat did kill Luna, it has to be under a cloud that's not necessary, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who loved Luna have to be in the dark as to what really happened, and that's not necessary. It's an unfortunate thing both ways.
Yes, that's true. I like that you said that it was that the focus really is on the celebration of Luna's life, and I thank you for bringing the story to us. Could you tell us when is the showing? The last
it's
showing.
7 p.m. at the Van City Theater on Sunday.
Van City, and is there a website people can go to? Saving Luna?
They can always go to ours, which is savingluna.com, and that will give them some information. Also to the film festival website also.
All right. Well, that's great. And I understand that this is one of the top 8 films, so I encourage people to get out and see it. Thank you so much for coming on the program today, Michael. We wish
it's
you all...
A real pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome, and I wish you all the luck with that film and your other projects as well.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to CFRO 102.7 FM. That's Vancouver's Co-op Radio. The program is Animal Voices. And I was just speaking with Michael Parfit, who is the producer-director of the film Saving Luna. That is got one more showing at the Van City Theater. It is... I think I'll let Alan do the next pitch here for our drive, our membership drive. Go ahead, Alan.
Okay, as you just heard, Co-op Radio does lots of very interesting interviews with lots of very interesting people, relevant stuff, and a lot of this you're not going to hear on other radio stations. The guest we just had, Michael Parfit, you might hear on another radio station, but what you're not going to find on another radio station is a program that is on every week and devotes a whole hour to animal issues. This is Animal Voices, this program, and it is a unique sort of program that does this sort of programming interviews every week. And Co-op Radio is full of interesting programs like this. Important, relevant, critical programming is what Co-op brings you all year round, and we encourage you to support Co-op Radio and help Co-op Radio keep bringing you this sort of programming. The station's been here for over 30 years doing this sort of amazing programming. Operate, all the voices you're hearing today are volunteers, at least from our end here in the studio here. We're all volunteers. And Co-op Radio is a community radio, a volunteer-run radio, but a listener-sponsored radio. We don't have big advertisers, big corporations. We don't get big money from government. We get money from you, the listener, and it takes lots of people calling in to support and making their pledge, taking out a membership, giving $50 or $75 or whatever you can give. 684-8494 is the phone number. Area code 604. 684-8494. There are people in the phone room waiting for you to call to take your particulars. Remember, you can pay by Visa or MasterCard. Anything you give is tax deductible. Consider being a monthly sustainer. You can give $10 a month or more, and that will just come magically out of your account into Co-op Radio's account, and it's really important to do those sorts of memberships that keep Co-op Radio on the air. The station needs money. It always needs money. A nonprofit organization like this is always short of money. And twice a year, only twice a year, we come on the air to remind you to join us and join Co-op Radio and throw a little bit in the pot to help keep the station on the air. 684-8494. And, Allard, did you have something to add? I'm going to play a little, we have a little promotional announcement for one of the shows coming up on Sunday. Especially, there are lots of special shows. Red Eye tomorrow morning from 9 to noon is doing a 3-hour show on food. And Red Eye is certainly one of our flagship public affairs shows. They do wonderful programming every week of the year. And tomorrow, when I came in today, they were recording an interview for tomorrow's show. They're putting a lot of work into this, and you're not going to want to miss that. And it's just one of the special shows that's happening in the next couple of weeks. I'm just going to play you a little announcement
before now. Before you do that, Alan, I just wanted to say that there's also an open house that's going to happen on the 28th where our listeners can come by the station and meet their favorite programmers.
Well, that's a great idea, and you could pay your membership then. But, yes, it's if you want, that's the 28th, you know.
That's the 28th. Did you have the time? Does anybody
No.
Oh, we'll find out the time before the show is up. That it's during the day. I think it's like 1 to 5 or something like that.
I'll find out and let you know. Anyway, 684-8494 is the phone number. We'll be right back. And we have a guest who I know I was just talking to a minute ago during that last interview who is going to be calling in just a moment, and he'll be talking about the film that Al Gore did. And, of course, we just heard that Al Gore won the Nobel Prize today, which is good that the sort of work he is doing is getting recognized. Anyway, hang on. We'll be right back. Don't go away. This is 102.7 FM.
Take a train next Sunday afternoon, or a boat, or a plane, or a skateboard, or an ox cart. Transportation, whatever gets you there, is the topic of the latest thematic extravaganza from song archaeologists Paul Norton and Jim Burnett. It's called Trains and Boats and Planes. It's on from 1 to 5:30 p.m. Sunday, October 14th, and it's part of Co-op Radio's Fall Member Drive. We're on our way to financial freedom, and it's your contributions that will get us there. What?
And that's just one of the amazing shows that you'll hear on Co-op Radio this Sunday. Before that show, from 11 in the morning till 1, there's going to be a show of music from India, which you might want to check out. And to stay tuned, you'll hear about more of the great shows coming up. And Allard has more about the open house.
Yes, I've got that the final hours there for you. We looked them up for you. And it is from 1 to 5:30 on October 28th. So you are welcome to come down to the station. It is at 360 Columbia Street. which is on Columbia between Hastings and Cordova. So you can come down to the station and meet some of the faces behind the microphone. We're going to have food from a variety of communities represented, because our whole theme is a taste of radio is food. So you'll get a tour of the station, you know, if there's prizes available from the member drive, and you can meet some of the people on your favorite shows.
And so, that's always great, because people will bring food from we have so many programs that represent different cultures here, Iranian, Palestinian, Ethiopian, Polish, and it's always, there's a great feast around Co-op Radio in terms of the sort of programming we have, but it's sometimes in terms of the sort of food we have, and you can come down and check out how the magic of radio works. So drop around on Sunday the 28th.
Okay, and Marge has a couple of announcements for us. Go ahead, Marge.
Yes, I would suggest you get a pencil or a pen, because these are about local activities coming up, and you might like to attend them, so get the information. The first one is called Walk for Farm Animals, and it's going to be held this coming Sunday, October the 14th, in Stanley Park. The starting point will be Second Beach. And the registration for this is at 11:30 a.m., and the walk itself will start at noon. There is a $10 fee, and that includes a T-shirt. For more information on this, you can get Joanne Chang at liberationbc, and she'll give you more information. Or you could call the Vancouver Humane Society, and that's at 604-266-9744. Joanne's line again is Joanne Chang, that's C-H-A-N-G, at Info Liberation BC. And the second announcement I want to mention is about a workshop that's coming up, and it's called Humane Education Workshop, which is sponsored by the Vancouver Humane Society and Earth Save Canada. The workshop is called Sowing Seeds, and it is presented by the Institute for Humane Education, which is a very well-recognized institution. And that is going to be on October the 19th and 20th. That's a Friday and the Saturday. Friday will start at 8:30 a.m., and it will go until 5 p.m., and Saturday is 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. The location for that is Spec House, I believe it's called, Society Promoting Environmental Conservation, and the address is 2150 Maple Street. That's in the Kitsilano District in Vancouver. And now this is cost you money. I can't give you the complete information, but it is especially for teachers that this is designed for, and there is a grant that the Vancouver Foundation has provided, and a limited number of scholarships are available to eligible teachers. So if you're interested in going to the workshop and find it's a little out of your price range, you might like to take this email address, and through that you could get the information and so on about the scholarships. Sowingseeds@humaneeducation.org. Sowingseeds@humaneeducation.org. Now, and let me tell you a little bit more about it. It's a two-day training session, and it's designed to teach you how to offer empowering, effective, humane education programs. And very, very highly recommended. I'm sorry I'm getting cut off of time, but it's something you might look into. And once again, Vancouver Humane Society, 604-266-9744. Is another source of information.
All right, thanks, Marge. And while people still have their pencils out, I want really fast here another announcement, and that is that this weekend is the health show, October 13th and 14th, that is at the Pan Pacific. You can get some more information about it, healthshows.com, or the toll-free number is 1-800-471-1112. A lot of our ability to help the planet is based on how healthy are you. Take care of your health first, and then you're able to take care of everyone else a lot better. So, Carl, what have you got going on?
Yes,
here?
Well, we have Gary Charbonneau. He's been waiting on the line here for a few moments while we've been doing some very important announcements. Love to see people out there. Gary Charbonneau is a vegan, a member of Earth Save Canada, and has been very interested in environmental affairs. He and his girlfriend went to the $500, $250 Al Gore spectacular presentation called Inconvenient Truth at the Bayshore Inn. Well, to hear all about it, please welcome Gary Charbonneau. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Carl. How are you?
Great, great. And so we're just really keen to hear what your impression was of going to this kind of gala performance at the Bayshore Inn.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, first of all. And before I get started, I don't want people to get the wrong impression. We do support 100% what Al Gore is doing, and we have no negative feedback in that respect. I mean, you know, he's a hero as far as the environmental movement is concerned, so hats off to him, all the respect in the world. But I do have a different perspective now on his seminars, or his presentations, I should say, simply because I think they've become so routine that they really need to be updated. There was the first thing that we know, well, I guess an amusing small little part was that it was raining that evening, and my girlfriend and I would have felt a little bit hypocritical had we driven down to an environmental conference or engagement, I should say. So we decided, well, we're going to don our rain suits and helmets, and we're going to pedal down there, and we feel good about supporting the whole movement and what he's trying to do. And the ironic part is, had we driven in a Hummer or SUV, we would have received red carpet treatment, but because we were on bikes, we were harassed. And so that was a little disappointing. I can understand the security aspect and accept it. There's no doubt that, you know, there was demonstrators out front, and it was, as you said, it was quite the gala, and the tickets were expensive. So when you show up with rain gear and bikes, people or security kind of tend to look at you, which is, like I said, it's acceptable and understandable. However, there should have been more of a protocol to handle situations like that, not just assume that we're demonstrators or protesters are wanting to cause a problem. We actually paid good money to, like everyone else, and we should have been treated fairly.
So you were body searched and followed?
No,
and,
we weren't body searched, but we wouldn't have had a problem, you know, if they wanted to look in our bags and all that. Like I said, we understand that part of it. And but once they brought us in and they knew that we had our tickets and, you know, if they wanted to search us, you know, we would have been fine with that and everything. I think they should have respectively, if they were still unsure, just respectively keep an eye on us. And but they didn't. It was like we were being watched and approached constantly, and we're almost certain that plainclothes security sat right beside us through the entire presentation. And it was a little bit too much, and it was a little sad to think that, you know, we're coming out here to support it, and we're the ones being looked down upon. And so, but like I said, they should have just handled that a little bit differently. That's minor, really. It was like I said, it was kind of amusing yet disappointing at the same time. I think people who walk or take transit or ride their bikes to support something like that should not be, you know, discriminated upon in that kind of fashion.
Right. Now, but, once you were in there, what was your impression of what was going on inside there?
Well, as you said, it was really a gala, and I had to question afterwards what was the purpose of the meeting, because I really and honestly feel that there wasn't going to be much action taken afterwards by a lot of the people there. I think, as my girlfriend said, it was more entertainment than education. Al Gore's in town; he's the flavor of the year, and you know, we've got tickets, and let's go to this big gala event. And that's really how we felt it was. And like I said, I got the impression that Al Gore is probably, you know, he's tired; he's working endlessly, and it's become kind of routine. But at the end of it all, there was, like I said, there was no call to action, and you have a very distinctive group here, and it's a corporate elite group. They've got the money to come to this kind of affair, and yet, you know, there was nothing mentioned about how they could, you know, make changes personally and professionally. And I think that awareness now is simply not enough.
What changes do you think should be done?
Well,
or what
I mean,
should they have emphasized?
Well, I sat back and thought for just a couple minutes of what some things could be done. And here they have, like, how many years have they've been doing this, and they've had a lot longer times to actually think about how to approach it to make it entertaining and simple and convenient for people to make changes, and there's really nothing there. And I'm sitting back thinking, you know, you can write, within a week, you should write a simple software program that emails people, which I know that most people that would attend these probably give their name and email address, knowing that it would be secure. And maybe once a month, just get a very simple email address reminding them of maybe a 90-day challenge where they only have to do a couple things a month. And then after the 90-day, they can just say yes to the email that they've accomplished it, and they've told at least one person, or have, you know, changed a light bulb, or have done something small.
Maybe you can emphasize what kind of things you would have liked to have seen them do, and emphasize that this meeting, which you felt was not being done.
Well, that's one of the things, that, one of the critical things, I think, would have been to have something in that respect where, like I said, this is just one example of many. Like I said, this only took me a couple minutes to think about, so there, obviously you'd have to research it a lot more. But if there was, like I said, a 90-day challenge for simple things for people to do, and, I mean, an automated email could go out from them, from Al Gore's group, and asking them, have they done it, reminding them to do it, give them some fun positive facts about what's going on, and then if they answer, if they've done the things after 90 days, then their name goes into a draw to maybe win a hybrid or something, you know, anything really, not just thank you very much, please be aware we have a problem.
Now, the fee that they pay these, of course, the British Columbia Prime Minister was there. This was, and of course, you have to pay enormous fees to these speakers, plus the venue. Now, who were the sponsors of this event?
Well, that was the other thing that I was going to get at, which is a critical point here. But just quickly to go back a little bit about the kind of money that, you know, Al Gore is making on this, and somebody actually kind of complained saying, oh, geez, he's making so much money on that. And I'm thinking, you know what? Good for him. I'd rather see somebody like that make over $100,000 doing good for the environment than paying somebody or a corporate guy, even a private guy, making over $100,000 raping our environment. So, you know, good for them. It shows people that there's money to be made, and I'd rather, like I said, see people do positive things and make a living from it than the opposite. So I don't have a problem with that part of it. But the second issue that I had was that has to do with the meat and dairy industry. In the UN, which they used in their presentation, the UN also came out with a 400-page document that stated that the meat and dairy industry is harder on the environment than the entire transportation sector. And yet, there's no talk about that. They don't mention anything about, I mean, the whole purpose of, or one of the main drives behind this whole campaign really is how to make convenient changes so it's not too upsetting for people. And I think it's a little easier to cut back a couple meat meals a month to a vegetarian meals as compared to going out and buying a hybrid, which, I mean, people should do anyways. But here you're talking about something that can be done that's convenient, and they don't discuss it.
So who were the sponsors of this, the big-time sponsors of this event?
And that's where you've got to question why they don't, because one of the major sponsors was the BC Restaurant and Food Association. And hats off that people are stepping up, even the Restaurant and Food Association, to bring in somebody like Al Gore and make people aware and everything like that. But, you know, I contacted the president of the Restaurant and Food Association, and I said, fantastic that you sponsored it. What are you doing for your part to reduce greenhouse gases? Because obviously the restaurant industry is a huge pollutant. I mean, you can't get away from that fact. Yes, it feeds people and all of that. That's fantastic. But there could be better ways of doing it and lessening your footprint. And he didn't really have an answer. He said, we're working on things, and rightly so, as he mentioned, we want to come out with things that work properly and that will be successful. And that's great, but where are they? What are the plans? Like, I mean, once again, you can easily think of, like, they can come out with a green card and give people a discount on vegetarian meals, or have a vegetarian month, or, you know, give anything. Anything is better than nothing. And as we know, like, action needs to be taken now, and there's nothing really happening. And
now, if I remember correctly, the Restaurant Association was also instrumental in opposing the smoking bylaw. So here they are, which came into effect some years ago. Is that correct?
I'm pretty sure most of them were. Definitely a lot of restaurants.
So they've changed the tune. But there was another sponsor there, a motor vehicle company. Was that correct?
Yeah. Well, there was a few sponsors, but the major sponsors were the restaurant and Toyota. And, I mean, at least Toyota, you can look at this company, and they've got the best hybrid system on the market, in my opinion. And so at least they're doing something, and their advertisements are coming out, and they're not just talking hype. I mean, you look at, like, a few of the big automotive companies, and you've seen for a couple of years now how they're going to come out with this and they're going to come out with that, and they haven't really done anything. And, I mean, Ford has a hybrid system, but it's actually Toyota's, which, I mean, it's great that they've got it. But, I mean, everybody, you have to be careful about how, you know, just because they advertise something, you know, it doesn't mean that their morals are in place. It just means that they're trying to present a good image. And a lot of corporations have done that just to get people off their backs. And
right. Now, you mentioned that going green is now profitable, and we applaud that. People have to make a living. But do you think this is going at the correct pace?
No. No, not at all. We're way behind. David Suzuki's been talking about this for, like, probably 30 years. I mean, at least over two decades. And, I mean, Al Gore's also been at it for very many years. And it's just come to a critical point now where people are now aware of it. And it doesn't help when you have a president like Bush who denies it all the time because he's afraid to upset the economy. So, you know, it doesn't look bad. Which
we have an economy that's predicated on oil. And, of course, this is... one has to question whether this model is actually working, and when you have these kind of sponsors here.
Well, the model is working temporarily, and that's because we have enough natural resources in the developed countries, and we have the cash flow to buy overseas and everything. But when you ask yourself, is this sustainable? And when you realize that in developed countries, people think that it's normal life, what we do here, like even in Canada, United States, Europe, and that, and it's not normal. We can't buy all the things that we buy. We can't consume the things that we consume because it's not sustainable. And a lot of people haven't gone overseas and seen what we've done to the forests and to people and to animals because we rape and we pillage because we're gluttons. With our consumption, with oil, gas, food, clothing, items, everything.
Now, you very nicely put it exactly what EarthSave has been writing in one of their editorials, and have repeated a number of times. And they, when the Inconvenient Truth documentary came out, they said, another inconvenient truth. And this other inconvenient truth is, of course, correctly, as you said, the 400-page report that was issued by the United Nations that showed that, amongst others, that 70% of the rainforest destruction was caused by the livestock production, the rainforests in Brazil. And, of course, that the enormous impact, I think you mentioned the figures, of the greenhouse gases from motor vehicles, from animal husbandry, was equivalent to that what the motor emissions are producing, the carbons from transportation. So it's a very valuable contribution that you make. I really applaud you for going to this event and supporting it and seeing firsthand what's going on. And is there anything else you would like to just in closing mention?
Well, like I said, I think it's sad to think that people have to be babysat. I mean, really, a lot of the reasons why people such as Al Gore, David Suzuki, and a bunch of others, they don't come out with a whole bunch of information because they know people have to be basically silver spoon fed. They don't like changes in their life and everything. And it's unfortunate as capable adults that they can't simply accept the information and use common sense and realize that, you know, they need to cut back. And yet, you know, it's a real struggle to try to find alternative energy sources. I mean, that's a positive thing, but to meet the growing demand, and when we should be, each and every one of us should be saying, we need to cut back. That's what we really need to do. And I just wish more people would, the general population would step up and take responsibility to themselves and quit waiting for corporations and government to change. It's their responsibility as well.
Go lighter on the planet and become vegan. Yes,
correct.
And there was a gigantic sign outside the Bayshore Inn when Al Gore was speaking there and the Prime Minister, and they were holding up a sign that said, eating meat is like driving a Hummer. So it was raining so much, not too many people saw it. So thank you for being on Animal Voices, Gary Charbonneau.
Thank you very much, Carl. You have a good day.
Thank you.
You know, I just wanted to add, too, that is another reason why people should support Co-op Radio, is because now here at this event that you were just talking about, there's these corporate sponsors who it causes them to spin and slant the whole agenda, you know, and there are things that people should have been hearing that they're not hearing about because of the kinds of sponsors that are there. Well, we here at Co-op Radio, we have no commercial sponsors. We have no agendas to placate. We can give you the straight goods and the straight facts as best as we can. And we can bring on the whistleblowers, and we can bring on the people who will challenge what's going on out there without having to worry that some sponsor who's got a commercial on our radio station is going to call and say, how dare you do that? Which is what happens at other radio stations, but it does not happen here at Co-op Radio. So this is one of the other reasons why you need Co-op Radio. We're doing our membership drive right now, so if you like what you're hearing, we sure could appreciate it if you keep us alive, keep us on the air, and support Co-op Radio. None of the people here that put on programs make any money. It's all volunteer. And so we do it because we love it. We want to bring you information. We want to bring you music, alternative music. We do it because we love it, and we want you to benefit from it. And so if you can help us by keeping us alive, we'd sure love that. You can call 604-684
8494.
Yeah, thank you, Alan. 604-684-8494. And you can pay by Visa or MasterCard. Just call in and we'll help you get that all sorted out.
And if you don't want to pay by plastic, well, we'll mail you out a little package that has a return envelope in it, and you can send a check in. So it's easy. However you want, whatever convenient for you is what we will do here at Co-op Radio. And I'd like to emphasize what Alart was just saying, is that you need Co-op Radio. You need the voice that Co-op Radio provides. But Co-op Radio needs you. This is symbiotic. We work together. You need us. We need you. Except we are you. You know, we're all part of this same thing together. But twice a year, Co-op Radio has to ask you to send a little money in, as well as listening and supporting us by listening and telling your friends what you hear and so on. Also, unfortunately, it takes filthy lucre. It takes money to pay for the phones and the electricity and all the other costs around here. It takes quite a bit of money to run a radio station. So we need you to and you need us, but right, it's all, and the way we can get together is if you give us a phone call at 684-8494. The people in the phone room are sitting waiting breathlessly for you to call and take your particulars down and help you become a member, become a supporter, become a sponsor of Co-op Radio. 684-8494, area code 604. And we have about 2 or 3 minutes left in today's show before we have to start to wrap things up.
Well, just want to let people know, too, that the show they have been listening to is Animal Voices. Carl, you got some final thoughts?
Yes, I've got some final thoughts, and I'll try and put it all in 2 minutes, or 1.5 minutes. Well, you know, we deal about animals and animal compassion, and a very good friend of mine lives in Mission, and she's also a programmer on Co-op Radio, the Brown Bagger, and Diana wrote, and she said, in the past few days, while working in my front yard, and in the backyard, I noticed a small brown bunny hiding and then suddenly scooting away when I came near its hiding place. Well, you know, she has a vegetable garden there, and she was somewhat concerned about what to do. She said, you know, in the neighborhood, people walk their dogs, and there are a few cats, lots of crows and robins and all kinds of wild animals. But what to do about this rabbit? So I wrote back to her and I said, you know, we used to have a rabbit that used to come and visit our garden, lots of greens there, but he belonged to a neighbor. We knew where he belonged, and he never ate any of our plants. Such a well-behaved little rabbit. We loved him. Probably he didn't eat any of our greens because he was well-fed. So, but of course, rabbits can be quite destructive, and they can have large families. Well, there is a natural repellent against wild rabbits that exploits rabbits' dislike of the smell of garlic. a concentration of garlic that, according to Protex, is 1,000 times stronger than garlic juice. So that's one way to go. Another homemade organic rabbit repellent is the soiled cat litter from a cat that has eaten wild animals. Spread such cat litter while still fresh around your landscaping trees or garden once a week. And that would probably... The rabbits don't like lavender, they don't like catnip, and they don't like foxgloves. So there you have the natural solution to the rabbit in your garden. And over to Marge.
Yes, I want to remind you of the Walk for Farm Animals this Sunday, Stanley Park, 2nd Beach, and registration is 11:30 a.m., and the walk starts at noon, $10 fee. So please come, help the animals.
All right.
See you there.
Okay, and then let's just remind people, too, get that today's the last day of the Vancouver Film Festival, International Film Festival. Be sure to try to check out some of those films, and they're having some special showings that they've added, which will be Saturday and Sunday. So go to the Vancouver International Film Festival to check out what's showing. Saving Luna is going to be showing on Sunday. And also this weekend is the Health Show, October 13th and 14th at Canada Place, so do check that out. And thank you all for joining us. You've been listening to Animal Voices on CFRO 102.7 FM. See you next week.